And welcome to the 15th Preston Thomas Lecture Series. I'm always a little, we were just sitting here discussing this responsibilities of this table here, because we can get water, we can wash our hands, but we decided the one thing we didn't need was a gas, because there'd be plenty of that here tonight, and we were safe on that standpoint. One very nice thing about lecturing in this room is you get the elements on one side and you get the architecture on the screen above. So some of you on the front row may end up with a neck problem because of the slides, but we'll still expect you to take careful notes and pay attention. It's very nice to see so many people here. This is one of the major events in the life of our college. It's one we look forward to each year, and it's one that's become an important and significant activity for our college. One real pleasure of this is to introduce Mrs. Thomas to you again. A whole new class of students have not met Mrs. Thomas, and a lot of you who will remember her from previous visits. Ruth, once again, please, if you'll stand up. Ruth and her husband, Lynn, have very generously supported this series over the 15 years. In memory of their son, who began a program in architecture here. It's been both their support of this lecture series and of the Cornell Journal are two very important activities in the school, and we're indebted to both of them for their interest and support for what they bring to us. And Ruth, thank you very much for all your interest and support. And her interest in this lecture series is only supplanted by her interest in getting the journal out and quickly. So you'll be seeing it very soon, and we'll have another opportunity to get together with Ruth later in the term. Once again, it's very nice to see all of you here, and let me introduce our chairman of the Department of Architecture, Val Wark, who will introduce our speaker.
I've had to jot this down because we have to make this tight, especially since we're dealing with theory here. It's probably necessary to do a theoretical introduction to Michael Hayes. So, and I know that the terminologies have to be very exacting. So it is fascinating and probably telling that Michael Hayes would select tracking architectural theory rather than tracing architectural theory as the title of this year's Preston Thomas Lectures, where he purports to analyze the ideologies evidenced in American architecture since 1970. First, there is the issue. The reason I think there's tracking rather than tracing, there's the issue of this free-floating K, which tends to hover around Michael. Even his name, some of you have noticed, begins with this phantom letter that doesn't particularly stand for anything. So why not let it nest in the middle of tracing, making it tracking? Fortunately, however, I tend to reject such residual semiological fol-de-rol, as we shall all probably by Friday, so there's no need to say more about that theory. Now, move more to the point then, there is the fact that tracing implies separation. We trace, for example, from outside. We cannot trace from within. It also implies the utilization of a transparent medium, you know, like tracing paper. Tracking requires us to enter the environment of the thing being tracked so that we might actively note the effects of that which has passed this way ahead of us, a broken twig, a print in the mud, or perhaps some architectural theory droppings. The media of tracking bloodhounds, for instance, are seldom transparent. So this approach, tracking, is probably a more familiar one for Michael Hayes. Having been born and raised in Alabama, a state still more than 50% forested land, where leathers and trappings are still vital industries, and where most youths are brought up as aficionados in the sighting of yellowhammers and in the forking of bullfrogs. Maybe he'll explain that during the course of it. What is most intriguing about the concept of tracking is that it doesn't distinguish the activity of the pursuer from that of the pursued. Both track. Tracking architectural theory, like tracking mud across the kitchen floor or leaves across the dining room in one's Dexter wingtips, cannot be done without somehow casting the tracker as the subject of the tracking. Tracking Michael Hayes, then. Since graduating with a B.Arch from Georgia Institute of Technology and an M.Arch in the History and Theory of Architecture from Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Michael has tracked architectural theory with about 15 articles. He's tracked it all over the Rhode Island School of Design, where he was an assistant professor in architectural history and design at Princeton University, where he was a lecturer in history and theory of architecture and chairman of the program there in history and theory. Cornell University, where he was a visiting critic, and at the Harvard Graduate School of Design, where he's currently an associate professor and director in the Master of Theory of Design Studies program in history and theory, and again at MIT, where he received his PhD in architecture. He's currently tracking it all over the pages of Assemblage magazine, which he founded and edits, and which, by the way, the Cornell's Department of Architecture is one of the institutional sponsors. Michael's tracks have been distinctive. He's left a trail of original insights, of enthusiastic plaudits, of translucent terminology, and of controversies, wherever he's been. Because he has a gift, though, for contextualizing ideas, difficult ideas and trickier yet, I think the ones that we think are easy, so easy that perhaps we don't even know that we have them. Because of this gift, we are about to be treated to five nights of stalking with an ace tracker. So let's prime our compasses and put on our waders and start. I'm sure we'll all go home with some trophies. Welcome, will you please, Michael Hayes.
Thank you very much, Val. I think. It's sincerely a deep honor to be here, having been chosen to give this year's Preston Thomas Memorial Lectures. Just to thank not only Val for and John Miller for the invitation as well as the introduction, but a few other people who have made getting this thing organized together much easier than it might have been. Amy Opperman, Brenda Hall, Margaret Webster, I'd like to thank for their help today and before today. And Ms. Thomas, it's truly an honor to have you here tonight. I appreciate you very much coming. In the mid-1960s, American architecture faced a twofold threat. It was threatened from within by a rapidly increasing technology that threatened to turn it into a sort of mere utility, threatened to turn architecture into a kind of rote utilitarianism. The versions of modern architecture received from the 50s seemed, by the 1960s, already moribund and of purely instrumental value. It was threatened from outside as well by the demands placed on it as a service industry, by the positivist inquiries of the behavioral sciences, of sociology, and operations research. In the 60s, things, you know, criteria like behavioral criteria, statistical planning, so-called design methodology, all of these attempted to make architecture into an absolute science. But in doing so, these activities sought to explain architecture away as a consequence of something else. They sought to quantify architecture's characteristics, effectively restricting, if not sort of blocking or denying altogether, its role as an endeavor, as a cultural enterprise, as an enterprise emergent in culture, with an epistemic status quite its own, with a claim to knowledge quite its own. Now, at the same time, the contemporaneous arrival of European philosophies and criticisms like phenomenology and structuralism, as well as the developments in linguistics, anthropology, and literary criticism in this country, were thought in the 60s by many architectural thinkers to offer sort of analogous frameworks and strategies for thinking architecture back into its own as a discipline, as a practice, as a mode of knowledge with a very specific tradition and history. And it's this history, this disciplinary history of architecture, that has come to be seen in some form as the condition of meaning in architecture. I say in some form because we will see this week there are those who conceive the disciplinary history of architecture as an enabling condition for architecture's continued intelligibility and one that should therefore be elaborated. There are others who see the same disciplinary history as a coercive constraint, as a dominant but also dominating discipline that should be dismantled. So this week we'll trace over the past two decades some of these attempts to either elaborate or dismantle the received architectural discourse, with special attention to theoretical issues arising in the fields of thought that I will be loosely terming structuralism and phenomenology. We'll track architecture's appropriations and transformations of structuralist and phenomenological concepts and principles, but as important, or actually more important, we'll want to understand architecture's having made positive contributions in its own right to these areas of thought. Architecture itself as a mode of knowledge, as a means of constructing a picture of our relation to the world, as a means by which a culture gives shape to its values and ideals. This is what we'll want to comprehend as re-emerging in the architectural theory of the 1970s and 80s. Tonight I want to begin by introducing a few concepts as well as an overall framework for thinking through architecture of the recent past, which will remain, if not to the foreground, will remain behind the considerations and investigations this week. But it's necessary to begin historically at a slightly earlier point. Now, perhaps it will seem trivial to assert that the fundamental themes of contemporary architectural theory arise out of various interpretations of modernism. Yet our point of departure for the considerations in this series of lectures must be the fact that within modernism there emerged radically new kinds of organizations in everyday social, technological, and economic life, and at the same time there emerged new conceptualizations of everyday experience, of the changed relationships between objects of everyday use, but also objects of architecture, relationships between those objects and their producers, and between their producers and their audiences. Modern architecture played a significant role in this sort of ongoing cognitive revolution, if you will, whereby the conventions of a society that had been formed by older modes of production, by handicraft in small workshops, or barter and trade of products over small store counters, where these conventions of a society were reprogrammed for life in an altogether different world of industrialized mass culture. All of which delimits the paradigm against which contemporary architecture has defined itself as well. If we could identify one fundamental moment around which all competing theorizations of the contemporary situation in architecture have turned, it would be the following question. What is the nature of the relationship between the structure of present mass society or popular culture or the culture industry, to give it different names? It's of mass societies developing economic, technological, political, and aesthetic life. What is the relationship between the structure of present mass culture and the specialized, even esoteric concepts, categories, and modes of perception and experience, which is contemporary architecture? Now that architecture is in the world, that architecture is part of mass culture and part of popular culture, that architecture is conditioned to some extent by the social and historical circumstances from which it emerges, would hardly seem a contentious proposition. But modernism and architecture, and the reason for starting here, is that modernism actually put that relationship into question. For modernism challenged the very cultural conditions out of which it arose. It saw them as crippled and incomplete, and it sought to forge an altogether different world. And this is the kind of attitude that we've inherited from modernism. And today still, the matter of the precise nature of the reciprocal influences between the various spheres of popular culture, whether it's technology or the economy or politics or aesthetics, and the special domain of architectural discourse this relationship continues to bring competing interpretations and competing positions in architectural theory into play, and sometimes forceful play. So architecture isn't easily reduced just to the to a sign that kind of unself-conscious product of the circumstances of its making. We would want to grant, and this is easy to say to students of architecture, that we want to grant its formal organizations and its conventions of practice a degree of autonomy, a degree of independence from the culture that they emerge from. And yet, works of architecture are neither wholly inward or self-referential or wholly self-sufficient. Architecture does not make itself alone. So we're led then to consider this question of the meanings and valuations to be attached to architecture in relationship to mass culture in our present commercialized, media-oriented capitalist society. And if you'll agree, if you'll agree for a moment, then in that sense, in the sense that we're still part of this industrial or post-industrial world, in that sense we're still participating in modernity, then questions of postmodernism as distinct from modernism can, for the moment at least, be suspended. And we'll get to those later, of course. And moreover, given what I've said thus far, it will not come as a surprise if I now suggest that the most developed and sustained attempt to theorize this problem of architecture's relation to popular culture or mass culture is given in the literature of modernism written from a materialist or a Marxist perspective. For it's that critical perspective that has worried most about the social determinants, but also the social consequences of art. In what has come to be known as the Adorno-Benjamin debate, the Marxist philosophers Theodor Adorno and Walter Benjamin each developed penetrating and rich readings of the modernist experience that I want to begin with tonight. Their interpretations are contrasting ones, and I want to use them to define the two preliminary poles of our critical framework. Adorno stands on the side of artistic autonomy as a defender of a difficult, removed, self-critical, self-referential artistic practice posed over and against a mass culture of instant assimilation and a kind of posed against the whole idea of reconciling art to everyday life. Whereas Walter Benjamin advocates a refunctioning of art based on the very forms and procedures of new popular or mass cultural transformations that industrialization or modernization had brought about. So we want to chart tonight those two poles and complicate that initial assertion a bit.
If I could have the first two slides.
Now, the so-called Adorno-Benjamin debate comprises Adorno's letters, detailed letters to Benjamin's writings of the 1930s. Primarily tonight, we'll be concerned with Benjamin's 1936 essay, The Work of Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction. In that essay, Benjamin concentrated on defining what he called the aura of traditional art before modernism and analyzing its decay under the impact of new cultural technologies such as photography and film. Now, the main thesis of that essay is that the historical and social meanings of art irrevocably change with the character of art's technical production, depending on the type of productive techniques the artist uses, depending on the type of productive techniques that are available to the artists, given by industry or given by mass culture, the social and historical meaning of art changes accordingly. That photographic reproduction and cinematic presentation had forever altered how art must now be thought. Now, the central category of the essay is this category of aura. Aura names the hallowed character of art, what Benjamin called the unique phenomenon of distance, however close an object may be. So there's a kind of, aura names the, well, the holiness, the removedness, the distance of art. Aura in traditional art arises, according to Benjamin, out of its ritual cultic function in, for example, medieval Christian painting or Greek mythology. I mean, one thinks of the 12th or 13th century Madonna on the left, and how it's part of a tradition of apprenticeship, of craft. It's primarily a functional object in the sense that it focuses the viewer's attention to the object of worship. It gives an image to the value systems that already existed in society. And over the years, over time, it would accrue this patina of use, a patina of age, and a patina of its function that Benjamin is calling an aura. The Renaissance cult of beauty later began this long struggle for artistic autonomy, or we might think of art for art's sake, by seeking to restore or maintain the aura of the art object, but now in an increasingly secularized world. But for the first time, according to Benjamin, in the Renaissance cult of beauty, for the first time, beauty itself was severed from the sheer social utility of the object that we could have seen in earlier times, like in medieval times. Now, this struggle for autonomy, struggle for art's sake, or beauty for beauty's sake, culminates in the 19th century aestheticism and its claim for a unique and completely independent mode of artistic perception, that there was something about artistic perception or artistic intuition which was unique and independent and no longer now had anything to do with social utility or social function. Now, Benjamin suggests that the reproducibility and mass dissemination inherent in modern photography and cinema, but also detectable in various examples of modern architecture, that this reproducibility operates to dispel any of the erratic traces left on traditional art objects through their historical functions as part of magic, as I said, or part of ritual, or part of religious worship, but also dispels any of the beauty for beauty's sake or art for art's sake that was left over from the secular humanist cult of beauty from the Renaissance. Whereas aura testifies to the authenticity and authority of a work of art in its cultic form, in its religious form, in its traditional form, that condition, so aura testifies to the condition of art's uniqueness, a kind of singularity in time and space. Aura testifies to the art's object's originality. For Benjamin, art based in reproduction or in mass reproduction destroys that sense of uniqueness, destroys that sense of unapproachability, collapses the distance, destroys even the sense of authenticity and rootedness in cultural traditions of erratic art. And with modern mass industrialized technology, the decay of art's erratic spell, the decay of aura as an object of reverence was now complete. Only then, only when aura had been utterly dispelled, as in perhaps these projects by Hilbersheimer, art could then become a potential instrument in the emancipation of the masses. And I'm just showing here, one might think of, without having time to argue, experiments in productivist or agitational art in revolutionary Russia, which Benjamin would surely have known as a possible model. Now, the social basis of this decay of aura is, in Benjamin's view, what he called the sense of the universal equality of things. So no more was there this kind of hierarchy between high art and low art, or high art and mass culture. Now that everything that technically reproducible art, now that everything had collapsed onto the same plane, which may seem like initially a kind of negative condition, Benjamin says it's this which has the potential to give this sense of the universal equality of things, which imbues mass culture. Artistic techniques of montage or radical juxtapositions of seemingly unrelated items, both in technically reproducible art, such as that of the productivist and Dadaist, but also of the surrealist, these artistic techniques, which are based in the idea of mass reproducibility, dispel the illusions of art by interrupting this kind of hierarchical narrative flow, or this illusionism of erratic art. In Dada Photomontage, for example, the photographic component of Dada Photomontage yields a mechanical, photochemical, reproducible imprint or transfer directly from the real. Unlike painting, wherein the uniqueness of the individual's brushstroke or the sign of the artist's hand is seen as a guarantee of authenticity and originality, the representational convention of photography asserts the images as mere indices of images that are already consolidated in the mass cultural world. For example, they're already part of the popular products of postcards or advertisements or illustrations from magazines or newspapers. But at the same time, they're held separate and disjunctively on the surface of the work. Such a fragmentation or an atomization of the material is governed, we could say it's governed by a system of meaning that's no longer immanent in the object, but is actually extra objective. I mean, there's something, the Dada Photomontage, Benjamin would say, is less significant as an object as it is as a procedure. That even as a procedure of appropriating, cutting out, and pasting on photographs from various sources, even as a procedure, there's a kind of simulation of mass production or simulation of reproduction. It's not autonomous. It's not an autonomous work of art, but rather a formal trace of the mass cultural world. The Dadaist Raoul Hausmann declared, "Our art is already today film." So that film became, for the Dadaist as well as for Benjamin, film became the primary model because it's film which is given by mass industrial technology, but it's also film which supplies the kind of possible strategies for the production of a new kind of art. I mean, think about just film for a moment, the whole idea of this flickering of images, the idea that as a procedure you cut it and paste it, so already the notion of the jump cut or the disjuncture or the assemblage of unrelated material is already inherent in film, as well as its anti-illusionistic qualities. I mean, we're too accustomed now in a way to seeing movies, but if you look at the movies of Hitchcock, for example, where the camera angle situates the viewer in such a way that you know the scene is staged. You know it's not. You know that you're not looking through a window into some naturalistic illusion, but you already know that the film is staged because of the foregrounding of the procedure of the camera or of the jump cut or a particular focus, something like this. So our art is already today film, Hausmann declared, at once event, sculpture, and image. And then Benjamin would later write about the Dadaist. He says, "The Dadaist achieved a relentless destruction of the aura of their creations, which they branded from the start as reproductions with the very means of production." Now surrealism similarly represents everyday objects in their precise materiality or their precise situation, yet like, again, montage and film, appropriates and then splices together or recombines unrelated or antithetical images to create this, if you will, an alternative reality, a surreality. And I'm showing on your right a frottage by Max Ernst, where you just make the drawing by rubbing crayon over different textures and then combining them in such a way that they seem to coalesce in some sort of image, but of course they coalesce in this surreality. Or on the left, a Man Ray photomontage. So the surrealist artist is nothing more than a kind of conduit for images already formed and coming from diverse sources, appropriating and assimilating them from diverse sources. The surrealist André Breton spoke of the artist as a modest recording device. He said, to compare two objects as remote as possible from each other, or by some method to place them together in an abrupt and startling manner, remains the highest task to which our art can aspire. Now, for Benjamin, surrealism was analogous not only to a kind of simulated mass production, but it was also analogous to the experience of the shock and fragmented images and the kind of chaotic experience of the transitory images in the modern city. He said that, Benjamin said that no face is more truly surrealist than the face of the city. So already kind of embracing or plunging into what would seem to be the negative aspects of mass culture, the negative aspects of modernity, its fragmentation, its repetition, its monotony, its collapse of hierarchy, but finding its shock, its transitoriness, but finding in that material, in that raw material, sources for an art that can emerge out of it, a truly mass art. So such strategies as those of Dadaism and Surrealism, according to Benjamin, are historically and socially conditioned by the masses' attempt to overcome distances, to overcome hierarchies, to overcome spatial and temporal, but also social distances. The surrealist manipulation of time, if you will, could be seen by Benjamin as somehow an attempt to overcome the temporal distance, as well as social distances, such as those between classes, between the distance between past and present, between public and private, between what's ours and what's theirs, between high and low. Benjamin explains this collapse of distance using the concept of, in German, this Aufhebung, which means somehow a simultaneous negation or nullification, but at the same time, a lifting up, usually in redeemed form, that somehow plunging into the negativity of the mass cultural world, but resolving it or reconciling it or representing it in redeemed form. Benjamin's concern was not with any sort of inevitable psychic depersonalization in modernity, but rather with the potentials in modernity and in modern technology, in reproductive technology, for the potential for emancipation. So thus, then, the historical trajectory of art can be seen as passing from religion, let's say, in medieval art, to beauty in humanist art, and then finally to politics in modern art, according to Benjamin. And I'm showing very quickly John Hartfell's use of photographic montage, which is not only perhaps the most explicit example of the political use, it's only the most explicit political use of this reproducible technology of photography and montage and sort of radical juxtaposition. So according to Benjamin, once art has passed through this historical trajectory from religion to beauty and now to politics, any attempt to create a self-contained, unique, authentic, or original, autonomous work of art in modern times should be viewed as hopelessly anachronistic and even a little politically suspect. Now, on the other hand, Theodor Adorno agrees with Benjamin that the erratic quality of the work of art was declining. He also agreed that this decline was not just an internal development, but it was one that was actually imposed upon art by external social and historical as well as technological transformations. But he objects to Benjamin's interpretation and to Benjamin's valuation of this decline. The modernist autonomous work of art, which Benjamin, as we said, has viewed as magical, artificially erratic, and therefore counter-revolutionary, Adorno describes rather differently. He stresses how artists working on what seems to be a purely hermetic, self-referential art were in that very production, in that very turning to the medium itself, the media itself, turning to the self-referentiality, were changing it, but very self-consciously, into what he called a technically planned work in which the erratic qualities of art are eroded, but from within, not eroded from without by sort of mass, not eroded so much from without by mass culture, but were actually self-consciously eroded from within. It was precisely by working within the very special medium of art, by refusing to collapse art into mass culture, that the imminent formal processes of a consciously executed destruction of aura or a consciously executed fragmentation and dissonance in the art could diminish this mythified, mythical, fetishized quality of artistic production. And for Adorno to try to politicize this art in Benjamin's sense, that is to place it in the service of a kind of immediate use value, to place it directly in the service of some sort of political use, was to destroy what was truly transcendent, or to destroy actually what was truly progressive about modern art. It's just interesting to note that somehow, as I'm just flipping through these slides as illustrations, that work like that of Mies van der Rohe that has appeared, or Hannes Meyer here on the right, actually seems to fit in either category, Benjamin's or Adorno's, that somehow, like in the Meyer's League of Nations, it's constructed of emphatically reproducible, atomized, modular components, but at the same time it's configured in such a way as to refuse or to destruct in its very autonomy any monumental aura. So somehow architecture is at least some architecture, shifting between these two poles that I'm trying to set up. Now, Adorno accuses Benjamin of two fundamental errors. First, Benjamin fails to consider the fact that there occurs in autonomous art or in a self-referential art, there's a kind of intellectual dimension which Adorno calls a dialectic of rationalization, this kind of intellectual dimension or this self-conscious destruction of aura on the side of autonomous art, which somehow parallels the practical dimension that Benjamin was wanting from art, or what we could call a dialectic of technique. So that somehow it was a very intellectual dimension of autonomous art that for Adorno was potential over and against any practical use, any practical political use that it could be put to. And it was in this intellectual realm that autonomous art proceeded to divest itself of aura, and also all of the sort of retrograde attributes. Now, second, Benjamin overestimates, according to Adorno, the progressive consequences deriving from this massified, institutionalized, mechanically reproduced art. Taken together, this means that Benjamin fails to account for something that was crucial for Adorno, and that's this element of negativity, that there's an element of negativity in mass culture that somehow Adorno saw Benjamin is not accounting for. Let's take the second error first, that he fails to that he overestimates the progressive consequences of mechanically reproduced art like film. Now, according to Adorno, the revolutionary qualities that Benjamin ascribes to the medium of film and the potential for a kind of class consciousness or agitational progress that he attributes to film audiences is, of course, contradicted by actual conditions of film viewing. On the one hand, the culture industry was already engaged in an effort to restore a counterfeit aura to film. Even though film may well be reproducible and it's disseminated on a mass scale, the film industry, of course, wants to attribute a counterfeit aura by virtue of a cult of stars, by, you know, sort of media hype, things that have become very familiar to us, by the sort of artificial reality that films seek to convey, and by the pandering to the sort of cathartic needs of an audience, the kind of desires of an audience for entertainment or diversion. In this respect, Adorno views Benjamin's embracing of this mass art as uncritical toward the practical powers of technique, and also as disregarding of the manipulative social ends that film technique could be put to in reality. Then on the other hand, Benjamin displays a kind of blind faith in the inclinations of the masses. This appeal to what Adorno said, this immediate appeal to the actual consciousness of actual workers who have absolutely no advantage over the bourgeois except their interest in the revolution, but otherwise bear all the marks of the mutilation of typical bourgeois character. So Adorno didn't have much faith either in the revolutionary inclinations of the masses. Now, so Adorno questions the very things that Benjamin is embracing. Would not this flitting of images on the screen actually leave the spectator more passive with less opportunity to respond critically? Don't the illusionistic pretensions of film especially lend themselves to seductive and manipulative employment on the part of established powers, whether capitalist powers or, in Adorno's time, fascist powers? For Adorno, a positive image of life cannot be predicted and certainly not produced by art. Speculation concerning any positive image of life always runs the risk of just being a mask, of providing a kind of artificial consolation for real historical suffering. So Adorno asserted that the utopia of art can never be this progressive, predictive one, but can only be a negative one. Adorno's views are developed in a later essay that's actually not on visual art, but on music, the 1938 essay on the fetish character of music and the regression of listening. And it's here that a more concrete and detailed articulation of Adorno's position is spelled out that I want to review just briefly. Now, to understand Adorno's essay, though, and to sort of prepare for later considerations during this week, it's helpful at the moment, if I could take a moment, just to introduce some terminology to define some terms that I'll be using later tonight and later in the week. The basic examination within which Adorno's the basic framework within which Adorno's criticisms are made is a sort of opposition between the concrete and the abstract. Let's say that the subjective feeling of concreteness or of density or of authenticity or plenitude in a work of art, or on the other hand, the feeling of abstractness, of dispersal, of impoverishment, of depletion in a work of art, is ultimately seen as deriving from the given historical moment of society itself, that somehow, I mean, standard Marxism, right, that somehow it's society structures which determines whether the art will be concrete or abstract, will be authentic or this kind of depleted work of art. Now, the opposition of the concrete and the abstract actually sponsors a more modern notion, the more modern notion of alienation. Now, the abstract and the alienated denote more or less the same condition. But the modern notion of alienation doesn't have a corresponding positive term. That the notion of alienation, that we're alienated from our objects, that we're alienated as individuals from any control of the technology that's bringing all this about, it doesn't have an opposite positive term. That is to say, alienation is purely a negative and critical concept that rules out any possible wholeness or possible redemption from the start. Now, for Adorno, or for Marxists generally, alienation derives from the division of labor in which the individual's experience of a unified or self-contained process of life or process of production, like farming or craft or something like this, was destroyed. And so the notion of commodification, or that objects becoming commodities, even works of art becoming commodities, commodification is a name given to the organized process whereby the work of art, like any object, is alienated from its primary and traditional status as an object of use value and becomes to be seen